Welcome, everyone, to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. Your host today, Marty Jones, and we want to thank Don Richmond for the music and Daniel Boyce for the bird songs that you're hearing. Our guests today are Deacon Aspinwall and Danny Robbins. And we're going to start with Deacon Aspinwall. Deacon is a 2015 graduate of Adams State University in geology and physical geology, or physical geography. And he is currently the planning and development specialist for the city of Alamosa. And perhaps even more pertinent for what we're going to be talking about today, he is a longtime member of the San Luis Valley chapter of Trout Unlimited and currently the newsletter editor for SLVTU. Welcome, Deacon.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're excited to have you here, Deacon. I have to tell you that I've known Deacon since he was a student at Adams State, and he is an outstanding student. He's also a really good vocalist. He sang with the choir when he was a student at Adams State, and a fisherman without peer. And that's what we're really going to be talking about today, is primarily fishing, since it is springtime here in the valley and waters are opening up. So if you are keen on getting a rod and reel out, catching some fish, Deacon's a good person to talk to. So Deacon, just tell us a little bit about why you enjoy fishing.
There's something very meditative about it. You know, to be out in nature, you have all the sounds of nature, all the smells of nature. And, you know, when I think about Zen, it's being able to focus on one single activity without interruption and without distraction. And so when I find myself fly fishing, I find myself fully immersed and incredibly in tune to all the different things, and especially in an age where we have so much distraction, it's really peaceful. It's very calming. And also, I think it helps us all understand just how precious and fragile our environments are, and how much we should cherish and protect them as well.
And speaking of our natural environment, you have a particular goal that you've established having to do with native fish, particularly native trout and other salmonid species. Can you talk about that a little bit for us?
Well, funny enough, you were there at pretty much the inception. I don't know if you remember this, but it was probably 2012, and I ran into you in Porter Hall, and because I understood that you like to catch cutthroat trout in a certain stream nearby, and I was hoping to maybe get the name of that stream out of you. I don't think I was successful that time. I think I had to prove myself that I was going to be a conservationist, which is very fair. So over 10 years ago, I became aware that there were not just one type of native cutthroat trout, but that there were over a dozen. And that certainly inspired this journey to try to catch all of the different native trout and salmonids across the West. And then in 2019, there's a conservation group called the Western Native Trout Initiative. They came out with this program called the Western Native Trout Challenge, which is a program that encourages anglers to fish across all the Western states. So that would be Montana, south to New Mexico, all the way to the coast, and Alaska, to catch a number of different native salmonids. And not all of them are included in the challenge, but as a kind of tangent to that, I also, you know, try to seek some of those out on my own.
And what states have you gone to meet the Western Native Trout Challenge?
So far, the only one that I'm lacking is Washington. So Alaska, California, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, and Colorado.
I think that some of our listeners may not realize that Arizona has some native cutthroat species. What What species is there in Arizona?
So it's actually not a cutthroat, but it's a close relative of a rainbow trout. There's actually two. There's the Gila trout and the Apache trout. And the Apache trout is completely endemic to Arizona. And the Gila trout you can find both in New Mexico and in Arizona, historically at least.
How many miles have you traveled in search of this?
You know, if you don't count flying...
Let's not count flying. How many miles have you driven?
Probably about 10,000 miles, if I were to guess, in different trips.
And that's been only in 3 years?
4 years.
4 years.
4 years, yeah.
What was your most satisfying experience? You can give more than one.
Sure.
If it's hard to come up with one.
The first one that comes to mind was having the opportunity to catch a Rio Grande cutthroat trout from an Aboriginal population. So a population that had never been, decimated by human impacts, never impacted by the stocking of non-native fish. It's just this tiny creek where these fish have persisted for thousands upon thousands of years. And I'll be honest, I shed a few tears when I caught that first one. And that must have been probably 2016. And since then, it's really certainly inspired this entire journey. I think one of my other most satisfying moments, and it's one that I don't tend to drop a lot of details about, but this past year I was very fortunate in catching what's been deemed the rarest trout in the world, which is the Paiute cutthroat trout. Historically, it was only indigenous to about 12 miles of stream in a remote place in California, which you can't fish. And they're actually just starting to reclaim that entire population and rehabilitate it for that native fish. The location that I was fortunate to encounter them was a very rugged and desolate place on the Nevada-California border, and certainly paid my dues to get there, but they're absolutely stunning creatures.
Very good. In terms of native fish, native cuts in Colorado, what species are present in Colorado?
So historically, until about 2018, there was a general consensus that there were only 14 cutthroat species, plus or minus some extinct. However, recent genetic evidence has come out and established that there's at least 25, they call them uniquely identifiable ecological units. I'm just going to call them subspecies because it's a lot to say. And so there's 25 total. Of that, there are two populations that are endemic to the Colorado River Basin. There is the yellowfin cutthroat, which is deemed to be extinct, which was native to the Arkansas Basin. There's the greenback cutthroat, which was endemic to the South Platte Basin and is currently being recovered. And then there was the San Juan cutthroat, which is just across the divide from us, and then the Rio Grande cutthroat.
And have you managed to catch each of those in Colorado?
Believe it or not, one of the few remaining I have on my list is the Grand cutthroat, which is endemic to a certain part of the Colorado River watershed. And not through lack of trying, it's just, sometimes you take these trips and you strike out, and that's just part of it.
Well, the cutthroat certainly are a less populous species than rainbows or browns or brooks. So it's not surprising that you would have difficulty getting all of those species. What advice... What have you learned during this odyssey? What have you learned in general, kind of a big picture viewpoint of how fishing has changed, how the populations have changed?
We human beings are really good at messing things up. And so often our unintended consequences are perilous. There are a couple of exceptions to that rule where somebody taking some fish in a bucket and putting them some random place where they weren't supposed to be actually preserved and saved some of these subspecies, which is kind of a fascinating, each one of these stories is fascinating in and of itself. So that's one of, I think, the big picture sort of things. And I think second of all, they're just so imperiled. Many of the fish that I've caught are really in desert streams that are maybe a few feet wide. I mean, tiny, tiny streams. And they've just been hanging on for, you know, the last century and a half or so. And before that, they might have had a smaller watershed, but they're very, very precious creatures.
What can be done, or are things being done now to help preserve the native fish?
Absolutely. I think there's been this whole groundswell, you know, really starting probably in the mid to late 70s, of the recognition that these are unique organisms, first of all, and then second of all, that preserving their genetic diversity, preserving them as creatures is really valuable for cultural reasons, for recreational reasons, and just because, you know, these fish have a right to exist. Western Native Trout Initiative is certainly a group that I am very fond of and support as much as I can, and they are obviously focused on Western Native Trout. Also, Trout Unlimited is certainly an organization that has a lot of power and does a lot of good in the conservation world, especially for native trout in certain regions.
What advice do you have for someone who might be just starting out a search for native trout? What kind of resources, what kind of precautions should they be taking?
I would say 90% of the work to catching these fish is having a good plan first. It takes hours and hours and hours of research sometimes to track down where these populations might be, because, you know, frankly, they're some of them are very rare and imperiled, and those little nuggets of information and breadcrumbs are not necessarily readily accessible. Now, one thing that the Western Native Trout Initiative does really well is they actually have an interactive map for each state that is a part of this challenge, and it identifies places you can go to catch them. So that's a really great starting point because it has a lot of resources, and it's a great initiative. I think it's $25 to sign up, and you can take an entire lifetime to do it. And, you know, you reach certain levels and you can, get a certificate and things like that.
What kind of equipment would you recommend to someone who's searching out for some of these native trout?
I would say 9 times out of 10, I'm using a small 3-weight fly rod and a pair of chute atoms. That's pretty much a go-to. Typically, if you can get to the stream, you'll have a fairly decent shot of success. As long as you have practiced your casting in very tight quarters, short casts. I am a fly fisherman, and that's certainly where my heart belongs, is, you know, catching these native fish with a fly rod.
So many of these natives are pretty small fish, typically small fish anyway, but I think I have seen some pictures of you with some native fish that required more than just a 3-weight or a 2-weight rod.
Yeah, so arguably the largest inland trout, and that excludes things like char, like lake trout, is the Lahontan cutthroat trout. Fascinating story. They're endemic to Pyramid Lake, and which is the remnants of an ancient glacial lake.
And that's in Nevada, is that right?
Correct, it's in western Nevada. And Pyramid Lake has a population of endemic fish that the record, I believe, from the 1920s was 41 pounds. Now, recently they've been able to, they found a population that had originally been endemic to that lake, which then, you know, subsequently died out to human, you know, actions. About 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more, they started reintroducing this specific strain back into the lake. And in that short amount of time, there are 30-pound cutthroat caught out of this body of water. This past December, I had the fortune of getting to fish in this location, and the largest that I was able to bring to hand was 15 and a half pounds.
That's a huge trout, though.
It's magnificent trout.
Yeah. What about right here in the San Luis Valley? You don't have to name specific streams unless you feel it's appropriate, but are there opportunities to catch Rio Grande cutthroat trout here in the valley? And that includes northern New Mexico, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And for folks who are interested in going down that rabbit hole, I strongly recommend they look at the resources provided by the Western Native Trout Initiative. So we do have the Rio Grande cutthroat trout here within the Rio Grande Basin. And just over the divide, we have the San Juan cutthroat, which is being reclaimed and reintroduced into Wolf Creek. We also have another strain, I suppose, of the Rio Grande cutthroat trout in New Mexico that's endemic to the Chama Basin? I'm blanking out on which specific, the Pecos River has a different strain than what we have here in the San Luis Valley.
Great. Anything else that you'd like to mention about fishing in general or encouraging words that you can provide?
The one thing that I always like to tell people is practice before you get on the water, because it will make your life a little bit less frustrating, especially if you're starting to learn out. Same thing for, you know, people who enjoy target practice or hunting. The first time, you shoot a bow or, you know, discharge your gun, it's not the first time that you're going hunting. So it certainly takes a lot of practice. And, being a member of a local group such as our San Luis Valley chapter of Trout Unlimited is a great way to get connected to like-minded folks who will help show you some of the ropes and occasionally give you some little nuggets of wisdom and some spots that you might be able to check out and also just explore. You know, any time you've got a chance to fly fish, whether it's here in town or if it's up in the mountains, it's always worth a shot.
Great. And I'd like to add that one thing I learned from Deacon was when you're going fishing, always carry a trash bag with you so that you can collect trash that other anglers have left, or hikers, or whoever, because it's better to leave the stream cleaner than when you arrived. Deacon, could we get contact information for you in case somebody wanted to perhaps join the San Luis Valley chapter of Trout Unlimited? Could they contact you and ask to be added to the newsletter?
Yeah, that'd be great. We do try to get some good information, and probably the best contact information would be to send an email to our chapter Gmail at slvtu303@gmail.com.
slvtu303@gmail.com.
You got it.
All right. Very good. Well, thanks, Deacon. We appreciate you coming by and speaking with the Outdoor Citizen and providing some gems of information. And it's always exciting. I have had the pleasure of seeing Deacon present on the Western Native Trout Initiative and some of his journeys, and it's just incredible. Thanks a bunch, Deacon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Excellent. And we'll take a short break and then come back with Danny Robbins. Welcome back to the Outdoor Citizen. Our guests for the second part of the interviews are Danny Robbins and Esteban Salazar from San Luis Valley Great Outdoors. You may know them as SLV Go. Danny has been a community connections coordinator for SLV Go since 2021. She's been in and out of the San Luis Valley since 2016, did her graduate work at CSU in Fort Collins. And Esteban is the a fairly recent addition to SLV Go. He's the health and wellness coordinator. He graduated from Adams State in 2009 with a degree in anthropology. So, Danny, you are here to talk about dark skies.
Yeah, definitely. Well, tomorrow we're really excited to attend the city council meeting and request that the city of Alamosa make a proclamation for International Dark Sky Week, which is April 15th through 22nd.
And why are dark skies important?
Yeah, so dark skies are really important to preserve our night sky heritage here in the San Luis Valley and across the world. We are really looking to preserve our night skies to protect our natural wildlife and ecosystems, to maintain public safety and health, and to bring economic benefits to the region through increased astrotourism and enjoyment of the night sky.
So the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve is already a dark sky park, is that correct?
That is correct, yes. Great Sand Dunes National Park was designated in 2019 as an international dark sky park, and SLV Go and partners in the Sangre de Cristo Dark Sky Coalition are now looking to broaden that scope of work and really preserve the entirety of Southern Colorado. We're looking to designate an International Dark Sky Reserve through the International Dark Sky Association's Dark Sky Places program.
And would that preserve include the entire San Luis Valley?
It would include part of the San Luis Valley for now. We're actually looking to kind of stretch the span across the Sangre de Cristo mountain range and include part of the San Luis Valley and part of the Wet Mountain Valley with the mountain range being our core, which has the most pristine night sky quality in the region.
And are you encouraging other communities besides Alamosa to also issue proclamations?
We are, yeah. We've worked with the city of Salida to do that as well. And this evening, Salida will also be making an International Dark Sky Week proclamation. And this is all with the goal to raise awareness about light pollution and to promote dark sky friendly solutions that will further preserve our night skies. So we want to be able to help educate the community and make responsible decisions about how to protect the night sky.
I know that this Friday in Alamosa is a First Friday's celebration of the We Love Our National Park. Will there be a dark sky information booth at the First Fridays event?
Yes, there will be. We're really excited to be there for First Fridays. We'll have information about the reserve, some cool maps, different information about how to preserve our night sky through responsible outdoor lighting practices. We'll have a DIY kind of constellation activity for kids and or adults, you know, if they want to try their artistic ability. We're really excited to be out there and to celebrate the night sky and everything that the park is doing and really build upon that effort to, you know, further protect the dark skies of the region.
You mentioned responsible lighting. For someone who is a homeowner or a business owner who is intrigued by this, can you give just a brief idea of what responsible lighting is?
Definitely. So with outdoor lighting, the premise is really safety and being able to light what you need and where you need it. So having outdoor lighting that is fully shielded and targets that light towards the ground is really important for visibility. And actually, you know, lighting that's more conventional and isn't shielded actually creates more contrast and shadows within our view, and really is detrimental to our safety and kind of creates hazardous situations because it limits our visibility. So having dark sky friendly lighting that's fully shielded, targeted towards the ground, only on when it's needed. So utilizing timers, motion detectors, and sensors, things like that to really ensure that you're only using light when and where you need it and in the right amount. Another factor I would say is the color temperature of the light. It's been known through research that blue light or high color temperature is detrimental to biological processes in wildlife and disrupts human circadian rhythm. So really trying to limit the emission of blue light and choose warm colored temperature lighting is really helpful.
And this information will be available on Friday at your booth as well, so people can stop by and get some better ideas.
Definitely, definitely.
Great. Anything else about the Dark Sky Proclamation that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, I'm just really excited to, you know, this will be our second year making the proclamation, and I think it's really important that the community recognizes the importance of our dark skies and you know, gets on board with preserving this natural resource that is so inspiring to many. And you know, I would also just say during International Dark Sky Week in the month of April, we have a couple of events going on. We have our third annual Dark Sky Photo Contest, which actually started April 1st and is going through the 23rd. And that's all about celebrating our dark skies while raising awareness about light pollution. So we're asking beginner and professional photographers to come to the table and submit up to 3 photos in either the deep sky or nightscapes category. And we'll have a panel of judges that will be able to judge the contest photos, and we'll be able to send out some prizes afterwards. So we're really excited about that contest. And we also have a night sky photography workshop that people can get involved in and register for, which is taking place April 21st through 22nd. And we'll have Frank Tarina joining us as an instructor and taking participants to Great Sand Dunes to photograph the night sky there. And there's also a classroom instruction portion to that workshop as well. And for more information about both of those events, you can go to SLVGO's website at www.slvgo.com.
And does that website have information about how to submit photos for the contest?
It does, yes. It has all of our guidelines and information about the contest. And, yep, you can submit your photos online there through Google Drive. And we also have our registration link up there for our photography workshop.
And I believe on April 22nd, out at the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve, that evening there's going to be a ranger presentation having to do with dark skies as well?
Yeah, definitely. So, yep, Great Sand Dunes National Park is having their locals dark sky night on the 22nd, and we'll be having a ranger talk and have some telescopes out for night sky viewing, and I will be there as well to help present and talk a little bit about our dark sky reserve efforts.
Very good. Anything else that you'd like to share with folks?
I think that's it.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Danny. We're going to move now to Esteban. Esteban, you're here to talk about nature prescriptions.
Yes, I am, Dr. Jones. I'm really excited to be invited down here today to talk to you all about some of the programming that we're doing under our health and wellness division for San Luis Valley Great Outdoors. One of them is the ongoing healthcare system partnerships that ties into our nature prescriptions. We hope to see this partnership evolve to a point where any member of the community can go down to their primary care physician or therapist and request a nature prescription as part of their care plan. We are hoping to target folks that are at risk for chronic disease, including heart disease and diabetes. But this programming is open to the public. And some of the exciting things that we're starting off here in April is public mountain bike rides. And we're going to start off with a series of beginner level classes. We're going to hold to a Tuesday evening bike ride at 5:30 p.m. and then we'll be doing them later as the days get longer in the year. As things move through the calendar schedule and spring and summer are upon us, we are going to be offering a intermediate level offering of public bike rides, and we'll be expanding westward to the trail systems out in Rio Grande County on public land. We're looking at Stone Quarry, Lime Kiln, and some of the new trails around the Rock Creek area. So we're really excited to partner with the Alamosa Bicycle Coalition to facilitate these events. We have a couple individuals who are working with ABC and SLV Go. We are calling them community ambassadors or embajadores. And these individuals are Latinos from the San Luis Valley community who are engaged and immersed in outdoor activities. We have Diego Francisco and Fernando Gonzalez. They are our embajadores who are going to be facilitating the bike rides. And I'm excited to share that information with you because this program offering is going to continue to grow in frequency and technical challenges as the summer and fall approach.
Esteban, what sorts of things might be included in a nature prescription?
Yeah, so depending on a patient's current health status, the primary care folk would develop and integrate a nature prescription specific to their care plan and their ability. And it could be something as basic as encouraging folks to go outside and get active in their yard or garden. Also, where we hope to, you know, bridge the gap is having public group walks at parks. And we hope to have these in Alamosa, and then we're expanding westward into Monta Vista and Del Norte. So we're going to have a weekly public group walk offering at the parks and trail system, and we are definitely open to identifying a diverse schedule so that they are consistently available, either in the noon hour for working folks or in the evenings for working folks. Also, we hope to have a regular occurring group walk for retirees, just to really embrace the entire community and encourage everybody to get outdoors.
That's so nice, because I know for me personally, being outdoors, going on a bike ride or a walk or something of that sort, it's good for my physical health, but it's good for my mental health as well. I get a sense of being a better human being by being outside.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's profound about the ParkRx America partnership that we're developing with a series of MD doctors out in California is they have a website that's hosted the peer-reviewed data for the physical benefits in addition to the behavioral health benefits of activity in the outdoors. So, you know, with the partnership we've created, our healthcare systems are definitely supportive of this initiative. The challenge currently is educating the public and getting them to consistently embrace outdoor activity in an effort to kind of stimulate a behavioral change. And we hope to do this through a tiered incentive model. So with a punch card system, we would have a series of hole punches mounted to a permanent structure on the trails and at the public parks. So our hearts are associated, the heart punch is associated with the parks, and the stars are associated with the trails. And an individual would be able to get an issued card from either myself or their primary care provider. And after completing the prescribed amount of visits to your parks and trails, they could redeem those punch cards for outdoor gear, things like water bottles and hats and sunscreen. And we hope to utilize this incentive program to get folks the skills and a little basic equipment to carry on this behavior change as a committed lifestyle change as they start to embrace outdoor activity more and more as part of their regular routine.
So how would someone get started with this? If they wanted to get involved in the Nature Prescription Program next week, for example, what's their first step?
Well, I think a good place to start is by going to the SLV Go Facebook page. We have advertised the next several weeks of our group bike rides. Also, and developing this work and our partnerships, we want the public to be comfortable reaching out to their primary care folks and their doctor and asking them about a nature prescription. Currently, we are working on a low-tech and a high-tech option for that. We have some sticky note prescription pads that a doctor can very simply write a brief prescription and hand it off to a patient during a visit. Also, we have a lot of ongoing interest from the behavioral health world, and similarly, a therapist would be able to write out a prescription pad. Our partnership with ParkRx America has a text reminder interface similar to how a person who is taking a prescription medication might be getting a text reminder to take their medication. They would be getting a daily reminder in text form to their phone so that they could respond, and hopefully that would encourage them to get outdoors. We also are exploring a bit more of a high-tech option in terms of using apps like Nature Dose and perhaps discussing the potential to develop our own application for this work. So things are moving forward, and we definitely want to encourage the entire community to feel comfortable, similar to how a person might see a pharmaceutical product on a advertisement while watching television. We definitely want to encourage the community to ask their primary care folks and or therapist about a nature prescription. And we hope to facilitate the programming and see more folks out on the trails and in the park systems and all the great resources that we have on the public lands that surround us here in the San Luis Valley.
Very good. Sounds like an excellent program. And have you gotten significant buy-in from the healthcare providers here?
Yeah, I want to say in the last several months, we've been hosting a monthly meeting, and we have some serious champions from within each established healthcare system, including San Luis Valley Behavioral Health Group, SLV Health, Valleywide, and Rio Grande Hospital and Clinics. It's not a hard sell to the primary care folks, the med staffs. You know, they've seen the data. They understand that this is an element of health and wellness that is not just specific to physical health, but also to behavioral health. There's been an increase in interest within this partnership, and we're excited for what the future may hold for this developing partnership.
Very good. Well, you know, the Outdoor Citizen is all about getting people outside. So here are two good reasons: a nature prescription and dark skies. And we want to thank Esteban Salazar and Danny Robbins for coming out and telling us about this. Any closing words from either of you before we sign off?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate the time. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back with some outdoor conditions.
Hey, Alamosa. This is Maddie Alborn with San Luis Valley Great Outdoors. Did you know SLV Go is hiring? The Great Outdoors Action Team, also known as GOATS, is seeking additional members to join their professional trail crew. Members need to be comfortable performing trail work, show a willingness to learn, be a team player with clear communication, and learn situational awareness while in the field. Some projects may incorporate volunteers or contracted youth conservation organizations, which require the support and oversight by crew members. All work is performed in the San Luis Valley on public lands. This position is seasonal because trails also need an off-season. with a pay rate of $19 to $23 an hour based on your experience. SLVGO is also seeking a financial manager. Reporting directly to the executive director, this position provides accounting, budgetary, operational, and programmatic support to all agency programs and activities. This position also oversees all accounting, budgeting, payroll, and benefits for our organization. This is a real deal, full-time salaried role within SLVGO. If you are interested in either position, read the full job description and apply at slvgo.com/jobs.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Citizen. Oh, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. Before we give you ski conditions, we want to give you some wind conditions based on an email exchange with Russ Schumacher, Colorado State climatologist and director of the Colorado Climate Center. We've been curious about the windy conditions both in 2022 and now in spring 2023. This is what we learned from Russ. The spring of 2022 was the third windiest spring on average in the San Luis Valley after 1999 and 2011. And March 2023, just 5 short days ago, was the second windiest in the last 20 years as measured at a weather station that CSU maintains at San Acacio. One last note from Russ. Quote, April is the windiest month on average in the SLV as it is in most of the state, unquote. So there you have it. Be prepared for more wind. Here are the most recent numbers from our local ski areas. Wolf Creek Ski Area has received 2 inches of fresh snow last night, 12 inches over the past week. Still great snow, 160 inches at the summit, and 482 inches for the season total. They're 100% open with 9 of 10 lifts operational. But you better get out there quick. Closing day is April 9th. Monarch Mountain has received no new snow over the day. They've received just about a foot in the past week. 100% open with 4 of 7 lifts operational. Monarch is reporting a 72-inch base and 265 inches for the season. Taos Ski Valley has received no new snow this past day, a little over 7 inches over the past week, and they're reporting a 91-inch summit depth. For avalanche conditions, avalanche danger is considerable right now, according to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. They said that winds on Tuesday will drift snow into thick slabs at upper elevations. This is where you can trigger avalanches. Winds are coming from a westerly direction. The thickest and most dangerous slabs will be found on easterly slopes. Look for signs of drifting snow, such as plumes of snow near ridge tops and cornices overhead, to determine which slopes are loaded. Avoid these slopes to reduce your risk of avalanches. Colorado backcountry avalanche conditions are updated every evening at 4:30 p.m. For the full forecast details and more, go to avalanche.state.co.us. And here are some flow conditions. For the upper Rio Grande, the gauge in Alamosa is reading a discharge of 143 CFS. Monte Vista is reading 256 CFS. And Del Norte is reading 400 CFS. The USDA is reporting 15.6 inches of equivalent snow water in the upper Rio Grande. And now for an outdoor field correspondent report. We want to hear from all of you on the outdoor conditions you're experiencing across this great high mountain desert. Whether you're biking, hiking, trailing, or just enjoying and experiencing the outdoors day or night, record an audio file on your smartphone and send it to us. We would enjoy seeing a photograph also. You can email info@alamosacitizen.com or text the audio file and photo to 720-891-6759 with your name for credit. Here's one from the Spanish Trails and outdoor correspondent Maddie Alborn.
Hey, Alamosa. Good evening. This is Maddie Alborn reporting in the field at the Spanish Trails. You can see behind me that Wolf Creek area and the Sangres are still getting hit with some weather. Wolf Creek was, in fact, closed this morning and today, but we have this beautiful sunset going on in the background. Springtime is coming. Can you hear that wind? If you're anything like me and a little bit crazy, you're already wearing shorts. I just passed a gentleman driving by in a Sprinter van on his way to do some camping, and he rolled down his window and he said, "Are you kidding me? Shorts?" I said, "It's springtime in the valley." Stay safe out there, Alamosa.
Okay, now for some outdoor news. Come summer of 2023, the Colorado Department of Transportation, CDOT, plans to construct a wildlife mitigation project on U.S. Highway 160 in Costilla County, located between Fort Garland and La Vida Pass, from mile point 258 to 265. The construction duration is estimated to be 8 months. The project includes highway safety features and wildlife mitigation components to reduce wildlife vehicle crashes. Watch for this project all summer long. In some ranger news out of the Rio Grande National Forest, Andrew Keller has been promoted to acting forest supervisor for the Rio Grande National Forest. He will serve in the role until late July, when Forest Supervisor Dan Dallas returns from his temporary assignment as the Director of Renewable Resources for the Rocky Mountain region of the Forest Service. And Patrick Moran will serve as Acting Divide District Ranger in Del Norte. Patrick is returning to the Rio Grande National Forest after serving as the Forest Soil Science Ecologist Climate Change Coordinator on the White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire since July 2021. Prior to that appointment, Moran was the Watershed Soils and Minerals Program Manager on the Rio Grande National Forest. The Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission has a wolf plan meeting scheduled for this Thursday, April 6th, in Steamboat Springs. This is the commission's first review of the final Colorado Wolf Restoration and Management Plan. The meeting will be streamed through the CPW YouTube page. And a friendly reminder from Colorado Parks and Wildlife to refrain from feeding wildlife. It is illegal to feed big game animals under Colorado law, primarily because it puts wildlife health and safety at risk, and many cities have implemented additional feeding restrictions for squirrels and rabbits. Those in violation are subject to fines, and even worse, could cause the animal to become sick and die. It's April, which means entrance fees to the Great Sand Dunes National Park will be waived on Saturday, April 22nd, for the kickoff to National Park Week. That night, the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve will also host a Locals Night Under the Stars event at the park's outdoor amphitheater from 8 to 10:30 p.m. Here in Alamosa, we're celebrating We Love Our National Park Month throughout April, beginning with a First Friday celebration this Friday, April 7th. And that begins at 4 p.m., a good place to start will be San Juan Avenue, which will be closed between Main Street and 4th. The 5th Annual Rio Grande State of the Basin Symposium will be held on Saturday, May 6, 2023, on the Adams State University campus. Sponsored by Adams State Salazar Rio Grande del Norte Center, the symposium will begin at 8 a.m. with registration and breakfast. The Rio Grande State of the Basin Symposium is free and open to the public. You can find more information by going to alamosacitizen.com. And now, calendar of events. The Valley Calendar is the most comprehensive listing of events from across the San Luis Valley. Be sure to check it out and stay up to date. San Luis Valley Great Outdoors, SLV Go, is beginning their group mountain bike rides for the season starting April 18th. The first ride will be at the Malm Trails in South Alamosa. These bike rides start at 5:30 p.m. and will last roughly 2 hours. The rides are beginning level and open to the public. The next two scheduled bike rides are set for April 25th at Alamosa's Inner and Outer Oxbow Loop Trails, that's out on the Alamosa Ranch, and May 2nd at the Riparian Park Trails. SLV Go is also hosting their third annual Dark Sky Photo Contest. The contest takes place from April 1st to April 23rd. The contest aims to raise awareness of light pollution and celebrate the magic night sky. All the details can be found at slvgo.com/photocontest. The third annual Valley Bottom Rio Trio is happening May 27th. The race is done right on the Rio Grande in Alamosa. This year's race will feature an 8-mile trail bike ride, a 3-mile river paddle, and a 5K run. Find registration info at rioraces.com. And I can tell you that before May 27th, we'll have a couple of guests on the Outdoor Citizen to talk about the Rio Trio race. And thanks everyone for listening. That ends this episode of the Outdoor Citizen. Join us next time when we talk to SLV Go about its recent San Luis Valley Conservation and Outdoor Recreation Survey. Until then, thanks for listening, and get outside, enjoy the outdoors.